Davis, we're here today in the matter of McDonald versus Nicholson, docket number 053159. Would counsel from both parties please enter your appearance for the record.
Good morning, Your Honor. Ronald L. Smith for Mr. McDonald.
And who's with you?
Mr. Zachary Stalls.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Richard Daly for the Secretary, joined by David Quinn.
Thank you. Now I have on my cheat sheet here, Angela Cross. Was she supposed to show today or something, or they just gave me the wrong information?
No, just the wrong information.
All right, give me your name again, Richard.
Daly, D-A-L-E-Y.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, we are, sir.
All right, each party will have 30 minutes, and you may reserve time.
Thank you, Your Honor. With the court's permission, I'll reserve 10 minutes of my allotted time for rebuttal.
10 minutes it is.
Your Honors, Mr. McDonald claims EJIA fees at an hourly rate of $150 for work performed by Mr. Landon Overby, a non-attorney practitioner admitted to practice before this court. The government challenges the EJIA application only with respect to the hourly rate. According to the government, $150 is in excess of the permissible hourly rate for non-attorney practitioners with Mr. Overby's level of experience and expertise. That argument is legally incorrect. The law permits Mr. McDonald to seek $150 per hour for Mr. Overby's service. There is no one hourly rate for non-attorney practitioners appearing before this court.
Mr. Smith, what is the market rate for non-supervised non-attorney practitioners?
Your Honor, I'm not aware that there is a market rate for non-supervised non-attorney practitioners. I believe this is a question of first impression for this court. The court, of course, has acknowledged in prior EJIA cases, and I believe that was Evington, that at least for paralegals in the Washington, D.C. area, that the petitioner in that case had established a market rate for those practitioners of $130 to $250 for experienced paralegals. Now, we do not submit that Mr. Overby is a paralegal. We submit, of course, that as a practitioner admitted under 46B2, he is very closely analogous to an attorney, more closely comparable to an attorney than, for example, Mr. Stewart in this court's prior case law, because, of course, Mr. Stewart is required to operate under the direct supervision of an attorney. However, Mr. Overby not only enjoys an unrestricted right to practice before this court, but in fact, as the essentially deputy in my office, he in fact supervises at least one attorney in my absence. So those distinctions, we think, differentiate clearly between Mr. Overby, Mr. Stewart, and attorneys. And while we're not prepared to say that Mr. Overby is the exact equivalent of an attorney, not having taken and passed the bar exam in one of the states, I believe he is as close to an attorney as one can come in his practice before this court without actually being a member of the bar.
As you are no doubt aware, our line of cases, I'll refer to them as the Stewart line of cases, since they involve the paralegal, Mr. Stewart. And the statute really focus on a reasonable market rate, and the court has a lot of discretion. So are you prepared to suggest what you think the market rate should be under these circumstances?
Yes, Your Honor. I suggest the $150 that has been claimed, and I have a basis for that.
That's a rate you're asking for. I'm asking you what the market rate is for people similarly situated.
Your Honor, I have to admit that I have not given thought to what a market rate for a non-attorney admitted under Rule 46B2 might be. The reason for that is that, of course, all such non-attorneys would work for veteran service organizations, none of which charge for their services, to my knowledge. So there is no marketplace where such a rate would have been established.
So perhaps we made a mistake. Maybe we never should have looked for a market rate. What's the salary? Perhaps this should be treated more like a paralegal in the sense of pay, not responsibilities and not jobs, but in sense of pay.
Well,
the Federal Circuit, didn't they recently come out and say that paralegals are an expense? So what if we were to look at this as an expense? I mean, this court has full authority with regard to the non-attorney practitioner.
Yes.
And we've taken a route that has equated a non-attorney practitioner at one of the highest levels of experience and given him $120, where an attorney got $125. Mm-hmm. And we've allowed a code to be applied to that. And today you come before us and tell us that you have a non-attorney practitioner who's just a wee bit better than the other guy, and you really want us to split this little baby between 120 and 125 and now give 150 to him. And effectively, you want us to take every single case and review them. You want to argue with the secretary as to what the rate is. So what if we look at it the other way? Why wouldn't it be appropriate to come in here and say, what is Mr. Overby's salary, and allocate that out by the hours, because there is no, as you just said, market rate. So what is the salary in this case?
I don't know Mr. Overby's exact salary. I believe it is on the order of $75,000 per year. And I would point out to the court, I wasn't prepared for that question, but I will point out to the court.
That's one of the beauties of this whole argument. You need to be prepared for everything. Seriously, you've come before us and you're asking us a question and spending an awful lot of time on an issue which we're willing to face because you presented it to us. But you presented it to us. So perhaps we ought to take another look at this, because if this is going to be the gamut that we have to take every single time, it doesn't seem to be a very good use of judicial resources.
Let's
go down this other side. If we're talking about roughly $75,000, we have a number of hours in this case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, but I have a point that I think the court should take into consideration.
Go ahead.
There is case law, and I believe it's in the D.C. Circuit, where the court was confronted with an attorney's EJA claim, and the attorney worked for a labor union. I regret that I don't have the name of that case, but I can provide it to the court. And the question was, again, there was no market rate established for this attorney's services because the union did not charge its members for those services. And what the court concluded was that the rate should be twice the salary of the attorney. And the reason that was so was that was intended to pay the credit union, to reimburse the credit union, labor union, for the ancillary expenses, keeping the lights on, secretarial help, all the things that go into an attorney's hourly rate. They don't bill separately for those kinds of things. So I would submit that if the court chose to go down that route, the correct standard would be not salary, but double the salary in order to make the employing service organization, in this case DAV, whole for all the expenses it incurred in providing the representation.
So you'd say it'd be $150,000?
I say it would be double whatever if you go back to approximately,
we don't need to get any specifics here, right?
That is correct. That would be the position that I would adopt in that case.
Okay. How many hours a year is worked? Have you worked that out?
2,080. That's a 40-hour week. That's 2 weeks a year, I believe.
Okay. So that is one approach the court could take.
That's one approach the court could take.
All right. And you
However, I would suggest another approach. The court should consider, for example, I just use an example, two attorneys who come before the court and they have an EJIA application. There's a senior partner and there's an associate who works for that partner. And the senior person bills at $400 an hour in the Washington area, which is a moderate amount in this market. And the associate bills at $200 an hour. Both of those attorneys are capped under EJIA plus COLA, presently about $165 an hour. In other words, there aren't two rates. The junior person does not receive payment at a lower rate just because he bills at a lower rate. There's one cap. And I submit that that is the approach the court should take with respect to Mr. Overby. Now, the court dealt with the prior case law in which the claimant asked for $120 an hour. Now, I wasn't part of those cases, and I can't explain why $120 was selected, especially in light of the fact that there was uncontroverted.
Well, you can explain or recognize that the court said that a non-attorney practitioner, by definition, is at some level a little bit less than an attorney, and without being disparaging to anybody. And the court said that.
And, Your Honor, I submit that $150 an hour in comparison to the current approximately $165 an hour with COLA that attorneys are being paid is a reasonable reduction given the extraordinary capabilities that Mr. Overby has demonstrated to this court over and over again. And there's absolutely no reason.
But you're asking the court then to step into every situation of a non-attorney practitioner to come in and establish the $3 differential between their level of skill.
I would submit to the court that there are a relatively small proportion of EJIA claims that come before a panel of the court for decision.
Until we render a decision that you're suggesting.
Well, not necessarily. If the court were to accept the position that we've adopted here, that
150... Well, we kind of thought that the position that was issued in the prior case law would be accepted.
The position in the prior case law is not analogous to this. In other words, if the prior case law in Apodacus is to be applied to Mr. Overby, then what the court is saying is, notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Overby accepts a higher level of responsibility, not only to the court, but to his clients, and operating independently to the full extent that attorneys do, he is nothing more than a paralegal and is entitled to $120 an hour. Now, Mr. Overby never claimed $120 an hour. Mr. Stewart's claim, or the claim for his client that was based on that, doesn't explain why, even though paralegals have a floor rate of $130, he wants $120. The court found that reasonable. I agree, too. And if he claimed 75 or 20, that would be extraordinarily reasonable, and the court would have no reason to challenge it or to question it. But because Mr. Stewart has asked for a sub-minimum rate, and the court has agreed, and I have no problem with that, doesn't mean that everyone in the future who's operating in this market should be similarly limited to a sub-minimum rate. Even if the court were to say Mr. Overby is nothing but a paralegal, it's not reasonable.
So, Mr. Smith, what do we do with the paralegal who does not have Mr. Stewart's experience?
I think what the court does is wait for a claim to be filed and see whether the government objects. And I would submit that the government is not going to object to reasonable claims. They have concluded that this claim is not reasonable, and they're making a perfectly valid legal argument for their position in this case. I do not accept the proposition that the government and the parties will be before this court contesting every single EJIA application. These things have to be worked out, but once they are, they should be accepted. There is no case law today governing non-attorney practitioners admitted under 46B2. That's what we're seeking.
And there is no case law, as far as I can tell, regarding a paralegal without Mr. Stewart's experience as well.
I would agree with that as well.
So that's another time that we'll be back in panel deciding more of these reasonable fee EJIA cases.
It's conceivable if the government decides to challenge it.
Let me share this with you, Mr. Smith, and I am in no way disparaging you or your client. I have the ultimate respect for you as well as Mr. Overby. But I am greatly disturbed that I am spending my time and my colleagues are spending our time here dealing with these kinds of issues. When we have disabled litigants out there who need to have their cases decided, we are looking at issues involving $5 in some respects. Now, perhaps we can adopt a schedule and have a base minimum for paralegals and another level for non-supervised non-attorneys and another level for supervised non-attorneys. But clearly the case law draws a distinction between attorneys and others. And it just disturbs me personally that this is where we are today. But I hope we can find some reasonable resolution so that we're not here every time there is a fee issue. It's not a question, it's a statement. Go ahead.
I have nothing further.
Do you want to reserve the additional time?
I believe I get reserved 10 minutes, Your Honor.
You just want the 10, thank
yes.
you.
Yes.
May it please the court. My name, once again, is Richard Daly, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. My co-counsel is Deputy Assistant General Counsel David Quinn. We object to both the rate at which and the amount of time for which appellant is seeking fees under 28 U.S.C. 24D. Appellant is not entitled to the rate which he seeks because his representative is neither an attorney, nor has he demonstrated with any sufficiency eligibility for the fee, even one approximating that he seeks. First, he's not entitled to $125. I think we can agree because the court and Congress made it clear that $125 is dedicated for the attorney fees. And Mr. Overby has conceded that he is not an attorney. Given that he's not entitled to $125 plus COLA from the appropriate date for that reason, we turn our attention to the basis for which we object and the insufficiency of his demonstration of his eligibility. This court has made clear that $120 an hour, as you've observed, is pretty much the, if you will, gold standard for non-attorney practitioners admitted to practice before this court. In those cases, the Mr. Stewart cases, as Your Honor identified them, The applicant there demonstrated with great sufficiency by the submission of myriad affidavits demonstrating his competence, his skill, his reputation, and his experience. The applicant in the current situation has failed to satisfy those threshold questions. In fact, he launches by stating with an unsupported allegation, with the exception of his own affidavit, that his market value, which appellant now concedes has not actually been derived.
Mr. Quinn, I'll ask you the same question I asked counsel. What is the market rate here? What should it be?
Begging your pardon, Your Honor, Mr. Daly.
I'm sorry, Mr. Daly.
My parents make the same mistake. The market value has yet to be derived, but the market that's relevant is the 27 non-attorney practitioners who are admitted to practice before this court.
What is the market rate?
We assert that there is not one.
What should it be?
Well, as a guidepost, I would suggest the court use the $120 plus COLA from June of 2001.
The same as paralegals?
Precisely. Because if you look at the legislative history and the case law development about the distinction between attorneys, non-attorney practitioners, and within the latter category, the two subcategories of non-attorney practitioners who are subject to supervision and those who are not, Section 403 of the VBA of 2002 essentially erased the distinction between the two. So the court should not treat supervised and unsupervised non-attorney practitioners in any distinct way, based solely upon that criterion, upon the court's review of specific idiosyncratic facts.
Isn't there a difference, though?
In terms of their eligibility to practice before this court, yes, but for purposes of EJIA, there is no difference.
Why? Isn't there a greater responsibility if you're not supervised by an attorney?
There is, but again, that's a component of this court's authority to govern the practice before it.
Why shouldn't that translate into a higher rate if that's possible to do?
Well, I would suppose that the court could exercise its discretion and go ahead and just distinguish.
What about Mr. Smith's point that we've got a cap? We've got the real world of pay out here.
Yes, sir.
And then you come into this EJIA world and you have this cap. And reality is you have attorneys that make tons above the cap.
Yes.
And I don't mean that tons in a way, but a lot more
right.
above the cap. And the attorney who gets $450 gets the same cap, same pay here. And if reality is, and I admit that's a big if, but if reality is that a non-attorney practitioner in the real world makes $200 an hour, why shouldn't they get the same cap, given the procedure we've established in the past case law?
Well, if you draw to the premise, the analogous premise between the superbly experienced attorney and the junior attorney, that is a question that one would have to ask Congress. Why two different caps don't apply? It's a matter of conviction.
Well, in this case, and this is one of the few areas, Congress literally gave this to us.
That is
so
correct.
So we're asking ourselves, and therefore we're asking you.
The answer, I think, is elucidated by review of, well, first the backdrop. When Congress enacted the Contract with America Advancement Act of 1996, raising the EJIS attorney cap to $125, it dedicated 2412D2D2, I believe. It reserved $125 to attorneys, and that was in 1986. In 2002, with Congress being presumably fully knowledgeable of the area in which it's enacting legislation, it went ahead and opened the door for compensation for non-supervised, non-attorney practitioners. Now, when it did that, it did not in any way change the language of Section 2412D. So,
but it didn't tell us we couldn't pay at the same attorney rate. In fact, this court is recognizing that non-attorney practitioners provide a valuable service and presumably as good as attorneys do in this specialized area because, one, they're supervised, and, two, they're in an organization that is devoted to this. You're not suggesting that a veteran who seeks representation from a non-attorney practitioner is making a mistake, are you?
No.
All right, then why wouldn't you say that you could provide the same pay given the cap, the artificial caps that have been placed in this particular system? I mean, that's reality.
Well, because it's not explicitly articulated in the legislation, either in the statute in 2412 or in VBA 2002, Section 403, and this has to be viewed in light of the fact that this is a limited, partial waiver of sovereign immunity, which is to be viewed as narrowly as possible. Where Congress does not explicitly open the purse, then the court...
Well, the purse is still closed at $125 an hour, COLA. I mean, no matter how you look at it, it's closed. It's not open.
True.
Entirely.
No, that too is true, sir.
Well, if you take the view and you say, okay, but we have attorneys who've gotten a law degree and they provide that sometimes difficult to explain expertise some way, shape, or form, and therefore should be paid something a little bit more than a non-attorney practitioner, which in effect is their argument here. I think they're asking for $150 ultimately. That puts us in the game of looking at every non-attorney practitioner. What about the idea of following the Federal Circuit's approach with regard to paralegals, given that we do not have independent cost centers here for non-attorney practitioners? They either belong to an organization and in that sense are supervised to a degree, perhaps not on the legal part, or they are directly supervised by an attorney. What does the Secretary have a position as to whether or not we were to change course and say we've gone down the wrong route of trying to establish a market value? There isn't any. Both parties have basically said that. And let's look at the real costs, and even accepting now a suggestion from your opposing counsel that we look at double the salary. Does the government have a position on that?
Well, Richland specifically articulated the position that the EJA is not intended to make anyone whole. So the reasoning behind doubling the salary to allow for the compensation of overhead, not directly reflecting the cost of those paralegals in that particular scenario, I think is unfounded. But again,
why did they allow it in that case then?
Why did they allow what in what case?
The doubling of the salary. Do you think that was wrong, that decision, or is there a reason why that would differentiate?
I'm not familiar with the decision that Capella referred to. But again, you have to draw back to the fact that Congress made this distinction. It's congressional intent, and in fact, the Federal Circuit in this court has recognized that there is a difference between attorneys and non-attorneys, but there is no difference between non-attorneys who are supervised and non-attorneys who are not. But the fundamental problem with establishing what's an appropriate rate here is that appellant has provided no helpful guidance. Again, he starts off with an unsubstantiated assertion that his market value, which again, we've addressed the issue of, is $125. There, it's in excess of $125. Therefore, he's entitled to the $125 plus COLA. I don't see how the former premise leads to the latter conclusion. But
Well, this isn't real. I mean, I don't think anyone will take issue with the fact that he does an excellent job representing his clients.
No.
I believe opposing counsel's position was that he's unsupervised and that somehow or another that amounts to an additional value.
Well, in that
should
regard,
that be something that we consider or not?
It should not. But to the extent that this, the court decides that it should, there is a distinction drawn that's illusory in this case. The references made to Mr. Stewart ignore the fact that in Abbey, this court explicitly recognized that in his 25 years of experience before, I guess the approximately 5 to 7 years experience that he had at the time of that litigation, he in fact worked for DOV in a supervisory capacity. If those facts were part of the record before the court that they evaluated and they set the benchmark at $120 to be subsequently by Epidacus adjusted for cost of living increases, that is a distinction without a in fact, it's not really even a distinction.
Mr. Daly, in Abbey, doesn't the court recognize a difference between supervised and unsupervised non-attorney practitioners? In fact, doesn't Judge Steinberg in Abbey, in his separate statement, indicate that congressional intent and legislative history suggested the primary purpose for the change was to permit unsupervised attorneys to sign off independently? I'm sorry, unsupervised non-attorneys to sign off?
Yeah, Ms. Judge Steinberg's separate statement, alternative view, I believe he entitled it, did disagree with the majority of the panel in the interpretation of this legislative history in that regard, but that was, it wasn't a concurrence, it wasn't a dissent, but it nevertheless was a minority view. So I'm not quite sure what weight that would carry, because moving forward from that case, in fact, in Pentecost, in the sister case to Abbey, Judge Steinberg signed off on that with no hesitation or reservation.
So wasn't the point legislative intent and legislative history, congressional intent? I
mean, yes.
Right. Okay.
So our position is, in short, he's failed to demonstrate the basis for the amount of the award that he's seeking. And as such, his pleadings have really offered very little assistance. And we request that the court assess his request and reduce it by whatever amount it sees reasonable.
You indicated at the beginning, I thought, that you're contesting not only the rate, but the hours?
That is also correct, Your Honor. The hours that we contest...
Didn't counsel say you were only... the opposing counsel, weren't we told that you were only contesting the rate?
He did say that, Your Honor. However, he cannot speak for the Secretary.
Well, what did you have in your briefs?
In the last two paragraphs of the response to his application, we took exception to the amount of time dedicated towards the application itself. We reiterate that and, in fact, increase it to include the application.
All right, so it's the hours associated with the application.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And in that regard, we simply assert that it was duplicative and unhelpful in terms of arriving at what would actually achieve or be a reasonable rate for his fees. Therefore, we request that the court reduce the amount requested, or rather, should it grant an award in the first instance, reduce the amount requested both by the rate and by the amount of hours sought. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I would like to make two very brief points. The first one is, yes, Congress did intend a difference, although the between supervised and non-supervised, non-attorney practitioners, although the legislative history is not entirely clear, it apparently was accommodating the concerns of service organizations that their representatives be permitted to practice without attorney supervision before this court. That seems to be the primary focus. With respect to the $120 hourly rate, I would like to say, and I think I made this point, but I'm not sure that I made it completely in my opening argument. If Mr. Stewart had come before this court and asked for an hourly rate, given his very high qualifications, that placed him in the upper half of the range that the court found had been established for paralegals, which was 130 to 250, then that would have been capped by the current statute. He could not have received reimbursement for his services at a rate higher than that. Because Mr. Stewart and his client elected to request a lower rate should not foreclose everyone else who comes behind him from making that argument. And that is all that we're doing today. If Mr. Stewart and his employer and his clients are satisfied with that rate, that's fine. Certainly anything under what is reasonable is by definition
reasonable.
Are you
suggesting that the court, despite its language in there about non-attorney practitioners not having the educational background, et cetera, of an attorney, are you suggesting the court would have granted a higher than 120 rate?
I'm suggesting that
if he had asked for 123, you suggesting the court would have granted that?
I'm suggesting the court might well have. What the court has said is that non-attorneys should not, within reason, it would be unreasonable or inappropriate to compensate non-attorneys at a rate equal to attorneys. We do not object to that. We find that that is appropriate. But the difference between the 120...
Yeah, but let's just take it. What happened was 125 was a rate, 120 was a rate. You're talking about a $5 differential that over time, because of COLA applications, becomes $25 or $30. So effectively what you're arguing on the system that's been established here is instead of the 120, it should have been 123 so that when you do the COLAs, instead of coming out to 135 or whatever it comes out to, it would be 150, which is what you're asking now.
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Since our determination is made on a base rate, and the only case that we have and all those derivative of it indicate that the base rate at the time of that decision was 120 and we apply COLA to that, effectively for your argument to flow under that system is to go back to whatever his base rate would have been at the same time, I guess. I mean, you can't get a base rate more than 125 for sure.
I think that the base rate plus COLA and the different numbers confuse the issue. Seems to me that the rate for attorneys right now is expressed correctly as $165 per hour.
Which is the 125 plus the COLA.
Plus the COLA. And what I'm saying is if Mr. Stewart had not come in and established this case law with the court, and Mr. Overby came in and said, I'm not an attorney, and therefore I'm not entitled to $165.
Let's wipe out all the case law we have on the attorney practice. No, just wipe it out for a second.
Okay.
All right. Today's today. He just comes in and says, I want $150. And we're going to sit here and say, why do you want $150? Because the law says no more than $125 for an attorney. COLID. So we're going to have to go back and figure out what a rate was under 125 on COLID. That's the way this thing has been laid out. Does it make sense? It makes sense given what we've been given. But that's what we've got. And the only other alternative that I can think of is, what's your expense? And by the way, if my math is correct, it works out to $72 an hour. That's the actual cost. Why shouldn't we focus on, and that's double, that's with the double salary. Why shouldn't we focus on that? Why should the taxpayers pay more than you're actually paying?
I would suggest that because the case law says that market rates would be established. Now, Your Honor says, well, we don't have a market rate from Mr. Overby. That's inconsistent with the fact.
I didn't say that. You both said that, as I recall. The case law says that they recognized one of $120 for a highly experienced non-attorney practitioner. And you're trying to say that this non-attorney practitioner is not supervised. That one was supervised and this one is not, and somehow or another that translates into a little bit more, and when you put it into this system, it makes it 123 or whatever to get you to 150 if you follow the system that we have.
Your Honor, I'm also saying that non-attorney practitioners, both supervised and unsupervised, appearing before this court, are more skilled and more responsible than paralegals.
Sure, but what do paralegals get in this court?
I don't know. I assume that they get the market rates.
Well, why would you present an argument to me and not know?
I'm relying on this court's decision, which says that it's established that the market rates for non-attorney for paralegals in this area is $130 to $250 an hour.
Right, but in this court, they don't get that. They don't get what your non-attorney practitioner gets.
I'm not familiar with the court's case law to that effect. I mean, the only case law I'm familiar with is the case law in these four cases, which says that Mr. Stewart will be compensated at $120 an hour and an Apodaca's plus cost of living increase, and that's based on some 2002 or 3 date cost of living from there. And I submit to the court that that's not what the statute says. Although the court has...
So what does the statute say?
Statute says there's only one limit on fees in this court, and that is $125 plus cost of living from 1996. And because under the amendment to the statute, non-attorney practitioners come under the same statute, and I submit they're subject to the same cap. That there is, the court has discretion to award less, but the cap is what the statute says, and that's for attorneys and non-attorney practitioners alike, and it's approximately $165.
Mr. Smith, why is 130.2 as a CPI used in the calculations for the rate here rather than a rate at the end of 2006 of about 126 something or other? Why do you use a current CPI rate?
Because we understand that's what the statute provides, that the statute provides a rate of 125 from 1996 adjusted for the cost of living. And we submit that there is no statute which limits non-attorney practitioners to a lower cap.
I'm asking about the cost of living figure.
I'm sorry.
Why do you use the most current cost of living adjustment rather than an adjustment that reflects the time period when the litigation was concluded? using 130.2 as a COLA adjustment.
I thought that was the midpoint, Your Honor. As I recall, when we prepared the application, that was the midpoint for when the work was done.
I thought it was different, but that's something we can look at.
If it is, then we're in error, but I believe we checked to make sure that that was correct. There was a time period within the last year or two where the CPI actually went down for a period of time, then it went back up.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, the case will be submitted. We will come down and greet counsel.
All right.